Okay.
We'll start with a little biographical information. Where and when were you born?
I was born in 1903, in July. That's corresponding with the Jewish month of Ninth Dagon Tammuz. Exactly according to the American date would be July 4th.
Mm. Oh, that's amazing.
The spring chicken is 74, then too.
Not yet.
73. All right, where were you born?
In Koprin. Krasna Gubani.
Ah.
Near Brest-Litovsk.
Ah, very, very good. And did you have any brothers and sisters?
One sister.
How old is she?
She's younger, a couple of years than I am.
Is she still alive?
Yes. Lives in Baraboo, Wisconsin.
Ah, it's a story in itself. What did your father do?
My father was what you call it, honest maker.
Mm.
In Russian that means a shonik. Mm. In the Yiddish is a rimmer.
Very. What kind of a business did he have? Was it big?
Very big business. Mm. Of course, it's just like today, the cars. Mm. You needed honest making.
Yeah. Did he service the goyim as?
Oh yes, mostly goyim.
Yeah. Now, you lived in the village.
We lived in a city.
In a city. Very, very good. About how large was it?
It was about 17,000 Jewish people alone. Big city, beautiful city.
And were the Jews separated off physically?
Well, the majority was Jewish people in town.
Ah.
So actually it wasn't separated separately.
Yeah.
As far as I could remember, it was about 20 synagogues, what I could name them, besides one of the big shul. Huge cold shul, the most beautiful pulpit ever. You could see, you couldn't find it all over the world, that handwork what was done in that shul. Terrific.
That's amazing. Did you go to Cheder?
Oh yes, mm-hmm. I went to Cheder.
Yeah. Until you were how old?
Till the First World War broke out. Then I went for a year till the Germans occupied our city. And the Cheder was disturbed, all the classes. Then I was going to go back to Cheder after it was settled down, but my father was in the army. The same rabbi was learning Gemara, refused to accept me after the Germans came in. He says, I'm not good enough because the reason why, I was a shagit. I didn't have 25 rubles to pay him for the zman, what you call it, for the time to go out to Cheder. So I said to him, I said, why was I good a year before and I'm not good right now? And I said, take all the Balabate from the shtetl, the pneo here, the big people, to examine me. If I'm no good, then you don't have to take me. So he insulted me. So I left and I didn't go to Cheder anymore. So I went to the Russian learnings, you know, the German set up classes. So we went to it was like public school that every child had to go, so I didn't go to my Jewish studies for it.
Was that the complete end of your Jewish studies?
That's exactly what it was.
How long did you go to the secular school?
Not very long, because we didn't have anything to eat, so I had to go out and look for work as a young boy after I became bar mitzvah. We used to go and dig in the fields after the frost let up to find a potato wherever it was left frozen, otherwise we would starve to death.
I gather it was hard to find work.
Yeah, well, My father was in service in the Russian army, and we were occupied by the Germans, so we didn't get any pension from the Russian government. So we didn't have actually money to live on.
No, sure not.
So I was a young boy, I had to go out and hustle to get anything to bring into the house.
Right. Did the Germans had no use for a harness maker then? Or they?
My father was in the army.
How could he, sorry. Two and two put together to make five.
That's right.
About how long? I asked you, I guess, how long you went to
yes.
secular school. Let's see. That means you were about 10 or 11 when the First World War began.
It was in 1914 when the war broke out.
Yeah.
In the summertime.
Right.
And I was about. 1903 was 11 years old, yes.
Right. At the beginning, did the war really touch you in any way? Did your father get called up immediately? Or?
My father was drafted the same day it was declared war. Okay. And he was accepted in the army. War was declared on a Tisha B'Av. I'll never forget it. And my father went to shul to say kinnis. And everybody was, he was crying and I was crying with him. That was on a Thursday. He got an order Friday to report, and Saturday morning he was already in uniform. After a month, he was in the cavalry with the horses, you know. After 1 month staying in our city, then the same Shabbos, when the bench for Swedish Allel, he was shipped out to the front to fight the Germans and the Austrians. And that time was really difficult, that Shabbos in the city, because so many people went to the front. And we never heard from him till Pesach. He came for a furlough. Yes, and then they come back, and he went back to the front again. And then the front came back to our section of the country. The Germans were chasing the Russian armies. When he came in, and he stayed about 3 days in our city, we begged him to really change his uniform to Romania. He was afraid to stay in town. He went back with the army. Then we had a big battle. Instead of the fight, just came to me. Instead of fighting, instead of fighting in Brest-Litovsk, which was a fortified city, they sent out all the civilian people. It was empty. All the refugees were in our city too. Instead of making a stand, the Russian army making a stand in Brest-Litovsk, so they started enough. And we lost 300 civilian people that killed in our shtetl, Kobri. And fortunately, we had a dog. I had a dog, and my grandfather allowed me to keep it. According to Jewish laws, you're not allowed to keep a dog. Even if I learned very little, but I know the Jewish law, and I still remember Gemara a little by heart. So that dog, that was on a Saturday before Rosh Hashanah, was going wild at the house, and he notified that danger is coming to our house. My grandfather could tell. He says, "Kids, let's get out of here as fast as we can." And it was a church school across Kitikon of Maz. He says, "Let's run in there." While we were running in, shrapnels and bullets were flying over our heads. People were falling like flies. And we ran in there. It was a very good brick building. And then when we got back, and 2 days later, after the war stopped, Our house was riddled with bullets all 3 inches in the wall. We could have got killed like in the flies if not for the dog.
So the church was left alone?
The church wasn't it. It's our house. I remember a shrapnel went in from one end of the wall. We had a store in the corner. It went through the other and exploded right in the middle of the street. And all the windows come out, and we were running out of the house as fast as we could. In the meantime, a woman got shot, wounded, so we tried to help her, but she died afterwards. Then there's 3 people was left dead. And my grandfather was in the heavenly condition. After it quieted down, he worked for a week or so burying the dead. And then it started a sickness, cholera, people dying like flies from the thousands of soldiers going through the city, and the dirt and the dead bodies from German and Russian soldiers, you walked over them, it was terrible. Then the Germans settled down and started rationing food, 4 pounds flour a week for a family or something like that. And you couldn't buy anything. All the Russian peasants left the farms, and that's what it was. So we suffered, of course. We didn't hear from my father. My father didn't know what happened. He heard it was a big battle in between the armies, but he didn't know if we were alive or dead till the revolution came. Then my father came home, well and good. My father was in this country before the war broke out. He ran away from the Japanese war. He was in the army that time. He was already, he was a young man yet. I was just born, a young kid, and my sister wasn't born yet when my father left for Europe. My mother was pregnant. So he established himself a big business in New York City with a partner, and they had a big business. He was in New York for 4 years with an honest making shop in them days. It was just as big as any car dealer today, you know. And they had a lot of men working and a lot of big companies, repairs and new work and everything else.
Right. I was just going to ask why he came back rather than bringing you all with.
I'll tell you why. Mm. My mother didn't want to come to this country. Mm. She said, Europe is beautiful, which it was. And America wasn't kosher enough to come to this country. And it was no honey and milk in New York City in them days, with the gas lights, with the toilets in the hallways, and the tenements building, and no sunshine coming through one another on the east side. So she didn't like it. So my father sold out and he came to Europe. Nice money, naturally. And the American dollar was worth 2 Russian rubles. And if you came down days with $10,000-$15,000, you were a millionaire.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
So that's why my father had to suffer and went to a war.
Yeah.
And then after the revolution, my father got home and the chores started. It was Petliuri, Belochovitz, all different gangs rose up, and pogroms was plenty. They went into cities, they cut women's breasts off and come in cashiers. They used to come in at the Jewish home and make the people dance on a Friday night and take everything they wanted in the house, beat you up, kill you, do anything. It was terrible, you know. It was disgusting. I can't even describe it, what it used to be. It was scared. Everybody used to be scared to walk the streets.
Yeah. Did these gangs have support from either from the government or from political?
They were the government.
Yeah.
They occupied and that's it. It was every different gangs come up with high fellows like Petliuri, big man supposed to be. So a bunch of gangsters, just hoodlums, of course, it's all left from the wars.
Yeah.
Then the Polish started to fight. The Polacks came in and occupied our section. They chased out the Petliuras. Mm. They were no angels. No. They didn't love Jewish people.
No.
They used to cut the beards and running trains to Jewish people off the train. And then about 1920, the Russians occupied our section again, the Bolsheviks. Chased out the Polacks, and the war was then. Naturally, when the Bolsheviks occupied our city, I couldn't stay home. All my friends, we went to school. We went to the Russian school, of course. And got jobs. All my good friends got jobs for the government. And I didn't care to go. But I couldn't walk out in the street. They'll take you down to forced labor. They'll grab you and send you away, God knows what. So I talked to my friends. He says, there's an opening in the city hall. You'll be just fitted in. You'll be accepted because you know how to speak Russian. You know how to write in Russian. I said, fine. So I went down and got a job with pay, of course. So my job was the worst thing there was. And they called it Rudovoy Hotel in Russian. That was like city hotel. It was city business. So anybody supposed to be taken for forced labor, I supposed to go down and tell them.
God.
Now how old were you at this time?
1920, I was 17 years old. So when I walked into a nice family, like they used to pick the richest people, it says the Balabatev from the shtetl.
Yeah.
It was intelligentsia. They wouldn't take laborers, common workers, but they took the high class. So I went into a Jewish man. His name was Shmuel Antopolsky, I'll never forget that. And I gave him respect and I called him Reb Shmuel. Which I didn't have to. I was supposed to call Tavarish.
Yeah.
You know what Tavarish means?
Comrade or friend.
Comrade. And he gave me an argument. I said, you may think I'm a little smarkach, a little nothing, come in to tell you to work for me, to go to work. You'll ignore me. I said, please do not ignore me. I'm begging you. Because you, in 24 hours, they'll shoot you. 6 o'clock in the morning, you should be at this in this place. If you're not there, boy, you know what's going to happen to you because I can't do nothing. I got the mark down that I reported. Then they used to tell me to take people for draft. Like you have a son or brother, come in tomorrow morning, you report for the army. Induction. People used to run out and they used to blame me. What do you want from me? Why take my son? Why take my brother? Why take my husband? Why take me? Go ahead and explain it. That it is me. It's the higher up. They got all the names. In the meantime, I was the goat. Then when they used to arrest people, they arrested people for anything. In 24 hours, they used to kill him. That's right, I just reminded myself. I had a neighbor, a goy. His name was Conan. Good Jewish friend. We were raised together. He had a son. His son was, when the Polacks accepted, he used to be in the Russian army for the First World War. Then when he got back, he became a policeman for the Polish. Then they put up signs that anybody served with the Polacks should report. He knew I was with the government, so he came up to me at night. What shall I do? I say, don't do nothing. Because nobody will report you because you're a good man, you didn't do anything wrong, and if you do report, you'll be in trouble. But don't say I told you so. He was too honest and too nice. The next day I walk into the courthouse, and what do you think is there arrested? My friend, my neighbor. I don't recognize him anymore. I don't know him anymore. I couldn't say a word, but I was turned on gallows. And we're trialing him, a bunch of students, you know. They are the judges. And they judged him guilty to be shot in 24 hours. And he was crying, begging to kill him anymore. It was my fault. Then another instance of also a neighbor, Schievenbacher, which we lived right next door. And I went with his brother to the same school. And he went to yeshiva for a rabbi, and he was talking politics in the street. Nobody heard, between Jewish people he was talking. The chair was Shaike, the Chekahu, you know, the Secret Service.
Mm-hmm.
Went by with big air, and they listened what he was telling, that the Polacks will be back and they'll chase out the communists and the Bolsheviks and this and that. And it didn't take a short time. They've been arrested. They come into the prison. They call it our stroke. We had a big jail, and it was a big city also. Zedel Gewürzmann is there arrested. I said to him, don't talk to me. Just I'll ask you your name, everything, mark you down, and that's it. His mother, his father, crying, what help? I say, I'll try my best to help, but I can't do much. Finally, they're supposed to transfer him deeper to Russia. In Russia, when they send people from one city to the other, they don't put you in Pullman cars, or in trains, or in buses. They make you walk from one city to the other under guards. We chains him, but this time they didn't have no chains. So I learned that he's going to be shipped out. I had a friend of mine, a guard. And I said to him, Zedel, tomorrow morning, in such and such a time, you're going to go out from here. But be sure and stay on the right side in this and this lane. When you get to this and this point on Pinsker Gas, there's a big ditch in there. Remember, there's a big ditch in there. Don't say nothing. Don't talk to any prisoner. Be on the last of the line on the right side. Just drop in there like you're dead and lay there. Nobody will bother you. Just exactly what happened. I could have got killed for doing that, but and the guard, my friend, too.
Well, the guard knew that this was going to happen.
Oh, sure. Otherwise, he couldn't do it. He would shoot him right on the spot. Then, while I was working, the war was going on with the Bolsheviks. Then another came out that all office employees who are working for the city or for anybody else are considered Red Army men. They gave us rifles. They gave us 1 week's training and they sent us to the front to fight. And what happened then, it was trouble. My mother was crying, naturally. My father was still there. What are you going to do? My rifle was bigger than ours. And I was pretty scared, but what are you going to do? We didn't have much training. We just show you how to put a bullet in and how to shoot, and that's it. It was fun. It was no fun. We didn't know what to eat either. We had an army of soldiers came in to the city. A whole regiment, a whole pole that's about 1,500 men, they lay down to rest. infantrymen. And the colonel come out and they told him to get up, and he wouldn't stand up. The answer was, we want bread. Mm-hmm. And there was no bread. While I was working for the city then, yeah. So we had to go out to collect bread in every home. If you had a loaf of bread, we took a half. If you had two, we took one. That was the orders. I walked in with my buddy to a home, to a Jewish home. They just got through baking bread. Mm-hmm. Like she cooks the fish, it smells. Mm-hmm. That's the way the bread smells. So in fact, I talked to her in Yiddish. I said, have you got bread? She says, no. I say, you better give us a loaf of bread, because we're going to take the whole thing away from you, because it smells bread. She had it buried on the bedding in a bed. And we took a loaf of bread. My buddy was not Jewish. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to take the whole thing. I said, no. Then one day I was standing in the marketplace. A soldier came up to a Jewish woman. She was peddling apples, you know, in the air. And a little pushcart, like selling apples. So he takes an apple, and then the Russian soldiers were not allowed to take anything without money, without permission. That was strict orders from that time in the army. He takes an apple and he starts biting, and he don't want to pay. And I'm standing and looking at him. So I said to the woman, why don't you tell him to pay you? Oh, let him have it. I say, no. I called him back. And I told the soldier, pay that woman for the apple. And she wouldn't tell him how much, she was scared. She thought I'm a civilian. I say, no, you pay for the apple. He says, who are you? I said, I told him who I am. He says, to her, how much you want? I say, give her a ruble for the apple. It was 5 cents. So he gave it to her. He was scared. He was glad that I let him go. I could have him arrested. Wasn't allowed to take it. So he wasn't afraid of him. Am I doing all right there?
Actually, no, I was just looking at the tape to make sure we had some tape left. I have to switch the cassette in the
mic. No, what else? Then what happened? We were chased back. The front was coming closer to our city. While I was in the army, I was still with the Hotel Tuda, with the city yet. Then I went down. The last bunch of prisoners were supposed to be shipped out because the front was coming closer from Warsaw. The Poland got help from the United States and France that time, including the armies, if you remember.
Yeah.
And it was. We are getting chased back as fast as we can. When we got to the book, it was more drunk people dead. We didn't need a bridge to walk over, just over the dead bodies. And the book was the dividing line between Latvia and Poland, you know. It was more dead people then than the wounded people, without legs, without arms. We didn't have no food and medications. It was a crime to see watching people die the way they carry. We confiscated every horse and wagon where anybody had it. I went into a big place, what was a milliner. Used to have a meal, you know, with flour and everything else. Right. Supposed to be a rich man. He had a couple horses. I went down and confiscated it from me. He didn't say nothing. He knew it wasn't my fault. I took away his wagons. We needed help. We didn't have anything. We didn't have no food to feed him. Medication, doctors, women, nurses. So I went on to get a list from the prisoners, and my officer, my over me, he asked me, what's new? It was out of town. And I said, it sounds like it's trouble. We're going to get close to the Pollock. The front is coming so close. And there's a very stupid, mine was a real anti-Semite. So he puts me under martial order to be trialed at the tribunal. And he went down and I buttoned my belt and my gun. there was a prisoner, so my other officer said he didn't see nothing. He just asked me what's the trouble. I would have been shot. And I cared less. You get numb, you know, you get so hardened up that you don't care for anything anymore. So after I was confined not to go outside without any permission, everybody was confined to the office, nobody out of the house. And there we hear the shootings, brother, it's frightening. Shots are coming. Shots are coming, and we are standing there shivering in our boots. You know, when they get Jewish soldiers, you know what they do. Communist, the Pollock shoots you. Without a doubt, they shot my friend. So what happened? The evening set down. And one of the officers didn't have a shave, and he didn't have no razor blades. And he says, what am I going to do? I say, you know, I could get it for you. And it was for Yanni, what they call it, a curfew, that nobody's allowed to walk the streets after 6 o'clock. No civilians allowed. Only men were.
So it's enough.
So he gave me an order that I'm going for the army, you know, so I was dressed with full pack, with a rifle, gun, and everything else to bring him. I was going to escape. That was my intention. He gave me another, and every block it's dark. My hair was standing like this. Scaredness. This the point. I could hear the shooting guy. And because I get caught by a Pollock, you know what's going to happen to me? And the guards, you know, were standing in every corner, soldiers. I had to show them my credentials till I got to my house. I was going like this. My heart was beating and scared. Naturally, you're scared, even you got a rifle with a gun. So, when I got to my house, we lived in an apartment building, which, I don't know, like in Warsaw they had it, when the doors closed, nobody could get in, nobody getting anybody's bear like to get into the house. So I was knocking and hollering. Maybe some people saw me. They didn't recognize me in the uniform, they wouldn't let me in. I'm standing like this, scared. Finally, one officer walked out. I wish a Russian officer walked out. And he opened the door, and I walked in. So when my father and mother saw me, I said, I'm not going anyplace, I'm staying right here. I was tired and scared, so I took my gun, belt, laid down and fell asleep. It was 11 o'clock at night. My mother and father were standing over me, woo, 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 shivering. Yeah. The Pollocks are here, right in our backyard. So I took the rifle, bang over the wall, took my uniform, buried it, changed to civilian clothes. We ran into a store where there was horses and cows, and I walk in there. A bunch of soldiers, officers, everybody is hiding. We got caught. We were surrounded with the Pollocks. And I had a pair of new shoes standing. A Polish soldier came in and took away the shoes right from my mother's house. My sister still remembers it. And then it quieted down. Of course, they chased girls, used to rape, and anything you could think of. And the Pollocks was no angels. So what did we do? I decided I got to leave Europe. And in the meantime, a trainload came in with potatoes quite a few weeks later. I went to get potatoes. And that Mr. Antopolsky, the one I ordered him to go to the railroad track, saw me. So he came after me. He says, what do you think you are here? You think you're the by the Bolsheviks? I'm going to fix you, you so and so and so. I didn't get no potatoes. I just took my sack and disappeared. I would have been killed. I thought to myself, boy, it's too bad I didn't kill you then instead of living your life. That for yeah. you to come up and tell me what I am right now. That's all a Pollock has got to hear. I'm a Bolshevik.
Yeah.
So I escaped and I said to my parents, I got to go, and I couldn't get a visa to go to the United States. So the first place I went in, me and a couple other boys, we went into the Argentine consul, and we got a visa, and we left Buenos Aires. We got to Buenos Aires, we didn't have the first night, we had to sleep, of course. We couldn't speak, nothing.
How did you get to the Argentine consul?
We got it.
Yeah, no, but I mean, people know about Argentina, that they had openings for Jews?
We know about everything. But Cuba, Argentina, Mexico, we picked Argentina.
Yeah. And now instead of the United States?
We couldn't get into the United States. We had to wait 6 months. Mm-hmm. We went to the United States Council. We didn't tell them what we are. But we couldn't get a visa for 6 months. Who's going to wait 6 months in Poland?
Yeah.
And that's where we got to Argentina. And I stayed in Argentina for a couple of years. And I don't know, what else can I think?
Well, how did you get down there? A lot of these questions are just
how did I get
questions.
Down there?
Yeah.
Well, we took a boat, we went to Holland, Amsterdam. We took a boat from Amsterdam, and we were 30 days on the water. We arrived in Buenos Aires, it was after Pesach. And we got off the boat. They wouldn't let me into the immigration house to sleep, but I smuggled in, and I slept on a cot.
Yeah.
And the boys who were there before said, don't take off your shoes because they're going to steal them. So we slept with the boots on.
Yeah.
They gave us Epsom salt to clear our blood.
Gosh.
Yeah, yeah. And in the middle of the night, I had some friends from before, you see, from our city, who left before I did. And they knew I were coming, so he looked me up, one fella, he's still there, and he says, how did you get here? I said, we are here. I said, can we get work right away? Can we get a job? He said, tomorrow morning I'll take you with me and two friends. And that was in Villa Crespo. I know you wasn't Buenos Aires, you may know where Villa Crespo is from the immigration house. To Villa Crespo, 2 hours ride by Stripka was that time. That's way out by Trinvarato, way out. So we came in, it was an old Jewish family there from the Baroniash Eniklach, what they call them. The old timers from way back. They were very nice people. And she asked me, what can you do, young fella? I said, I'll tell you what I could do. I don't know, my father was an honest maker, but I never learned the trade. I didn't have the chance. But my grandfather was a tucker. You know what a tucker? A wood turner.
Yeah.
And finishing furniture like this. And I said, I could be a good finisher for furniture. She says, I got a job for you. The other fellow, she got jobs too in different trades. Me, she gave a job to a Jewish man. He came from Odessa. He lived there. And he had a small shop which he was making novelty tables. Inlaid. Next, he says to me, can you do mixing colors? I said, yes. And I love that work. He says, the first week I'll give you 6 passes a week and dinners. I said, how about a place to sleep? He says, I don't, you know, they don't have it there. So we slept in that old lady's yard, and we didn't want to go back to the immigration house. It was too hours, right? One way and 2 hours the other way. That's warm. But it was warm. Today it was winter, but to us was summer. We felt. So finally, the second week he gave me $12. The third week he gave me $18. To make a short story, 6 weeks I was earning 60 pesos a week. I was turning out beautiful work, and he was very happy with me. Then I started making money, and a friend of mine was working with the same trade. We rented a nice room by a Jewish old-time family on Bartolomé Mitre, upstairs, you know, little steps used to walk. And that lady was a very aristocratic woman. She says, what are you Jewish kids doing for a living, to live in a nice neighborhood like I am? We even bought iron beds, you know, the days. And we told her what we're doing, and she says, it's too bad your kids left it for this type of work, because working with alcohol is shellac, you know, it's not healthy, it goes to fumes. You know. So in the meantime, I got acquainted with an English woman from England, and her husband was a tailor, they didn't have no children. I was introduced to me, and I made acquaintances with other people. I had addresses to other people who used to live there before. And I had guts enough, and I didn't like restaurants. And I said to her, Mrs. Arbitzman, Senora Arbitzman, would you accept me? He's a woman and a boarder. I want to eat and sleep by you. She says, yes. She says, can you afford it? I say, yes. I want $60 a month. I said, I'm willing. Any amount you want, I'm willing to pay. I bought my own bed there. My Russian clothing, what I had from the army, the blankets. She loved it. I left it there. And she introduced me as a child. But in the meantime, I didn't like the work. In this place, the landlady, was a sweetheart to the guy who worked for the government, the Hyatt, the big shot. And I used to already speak Spanish as much as I could. After 3-4 months later, and I said, maybe I could get a job with these people for the government.
Hey, how did you learn Spanish?
Wait. So she talked to her sweetheart. He was a married man, but she had good times with the other guy. He was a handsome looking fellow and a rich man. So she asked him for me to get a job there. And he said, you come down Monday morning and we'll see what we can do. In the meantime, the big chief come out, talked to me. I didn't know what the hell was saying. And I was accepted. And I was turned in to the job. I was accepted. Dinner time, they come up and they said, you start working this afternoon. When I got the job and I was put in the inspection department, you know, everything had to go through. They used to make army things for the army, for the government. Chemicals, paints. And that was my line, good. I was fitting right. The foreman, I don't remember exactly if it was that Perón who was the dictator from Argentina, but his name was Domingo Perón.
Coincidence.
Must be relational, maybe he was a dictator. He had a beautiful wife, the first one. Beautiful señorita with dark hair. And his brother was the accountant there, and when he put me to the table to work in his department, and he started asking me questions, he was the foreman over me. He says to me, how did you get in on this type of a job? You're a gringo. He says, you don't speak a good Spanish. You don't know the work. What do you got, a good-looking sister? That's exactly what he said. I said, no, I said, so-and-so recommended me on the job. Oh, then you're my friend. Then he started teaching me. He says, I'm going to teach you how to speak Spanish, which it was not hard to get. Oh, I used to be it was very nice to me. And I was the only Jewish man in that plant for 500 people. Anything was supposed to be, I used to take his work and they liked me. We used to work from 7 till 11, from 11 till 1 dinner, then from 1 till 5, but I used to work overtime, 2 hours. Finally, after 3 months working there, and I said, Domingo, how can I get a raise? I need more money. He says, you got to talk to Mr. So-and-so. What should I tell him? Scared? He says, you tell him this and that. And he used to watch me. I'll do the work. Oh, yeah, it was like secret eyes. If I'm goofing off, but I turned out twice as much work than anybody else. So when I team, took up coach and gave him up, Don Manuel, I gave him his title and took my number, went up in the office and he gave me a raise. He used to get paid twice a month. But Mr. Domingo didn't want to wait. So he went up right in the office after the big shot left. And he checked it with his brother, how much I got a raise. I got the biggest raise that any man ever had. I was making a fact as much money, maybe more than the big shots were making. He says, my guy, says, that calls for celebration. And I told him, I'm Jewish. I didn't want to hide my Jewish identity, but Yom Tov came, I said, I don't work. Especially from Europe, and I was full. And I said, okay, let's take the crew, girlfriends, sweethearts, wives. It doesn't mean you want to see what a Jewish boy can do. Mm-hmm. So I said, you pick the place and the time. So we did, we go out to a nice restaurant, we ate, we drank, come out to pay the bill is paid. And I didn't like it. He said, I wanted to see what the Jew is like. I said, you just insulted me. He says, no, I'll be with the soldiers. So I went down and bought him a nice present for the home and for the meeting. I bought it a bigger present than he paid for the meal. Because food that time wasn't expensive. And I used to get for 10 cents a quarter wine, a whole liter. Then I was working there. They transferred a Shegetz, an anti-Semite, a 20-year-old boy. And I was singing anti-Semitic songs. And I was speaking a good Spanish and I didn't like it. And he used to take chemicals, sprinkle on my uniform. I gave him one warning, another warning. I said, the third time you're not going to get no warning. Some of us is going to get his head chopped off. I'm a redhead and I got a temper. He didn't listen to me. And he didn't have no father and he needed the money to work there. I was a favorite son in that plant. I was holding a big brush. And I got up and hit him right there. And he knocked out 2 teeth was flying and blood coming out of his mouth. And he got up and hit me right straight in my chest and I fell backwards. And the foreman, Domingo, ran away. Didn't want to take parts. And he went to the washroom to wash himself out. And I quiet down, and all the gang was standing there. We're going to me, here, we'll fix you. I saw a man got stabbed with a knife in front of me before, right in there. They got tempers, you know, Spanish. Hit him right there with a knife. And I figured, but I felt sorry afterwards, you know, but it's too late. 5 o'clock the bell rings, you don't go home. I never worked overtime. 6 o'clock the bell rings, you don't go home. So I get up and get myself a lead big pipe, stick it right in my pants. And I said, in case anything happens, I'm gonna fight back. I ain't gonna take it standing up. I said, I know how to handle myself. So we had to go out in pairs because people used to steal. It was expensive chemical stuffs there. and God was standing at the door, and he come out of my sight, on my left, two of us. He walked out his way, and I walked out my way. When I got home, I washed myself off, took a shower, and we stand the showers outside if you see them, maybe for your times too. And I ate supper, and the lady who recommended me, she says, Rubio, to me, you don't look good to me. She says, you're excited something. I say, oh, no, nothing at all. So I took a friend of mine. I said, you want to go with me on the Triumvirato? We didn't live far away. We lived at Casa Padilla. The Triumvirato was a block away. Main street, like State Street or something like it, but it was much nicer than State Street. And I said, I want to buy something. I didn't tell him what happened. Nobody. So I was standing and looking in a window, and here he appears with another boy. And he start talking to me. He says, you know, I felt sorry for you because you're all alone. Otherwise, he says, I would give you a good beating. I say, you know, I don't like anybody to feel sorry for me because I don't want nobody to feel sorry for me. If you got 25 pesos in your pocket, I'll show you what I feel sorry in case you let anybody blood out. You know, you paid 25 pesos for it. I say, you want to fight it out? I'll take you right down here on the street and I'll just let you give you a lesson. And I say, from now on, buddy, you're not my friend. I say, you're going to do the work or else you're going to get fired. You're not going to goof off in the shop. Domingo must have told him. He says, you started up with the wrong guy. You're going to get killed. You're going to be, he's going to be on your tail every day. You don't do anything right. And that's just exactly what he started crying, begging me to forgive him. And he's sorry. And he wanted to take me out for a treat there. He used to have ice cream parlors, you know. And he used to have, I don't know, maybe for you, there is not. They used to have entertainment for a quarter. You could have ice cream and sit down and eat ice cream, and girls used to, music used to play, and girls used to dance right off the street.
I don't remember that. The ice cream.
I said, okay. He begged me, and I didn't want to go. Finally, I went. He says he's going to treat me, but I wouldn't let him treat me because he needed the money worse than I did. I was making more money than him. Then he became my best friend, just like a good dog, a watchdog. And then I decided, my father came to the United States, my mother was in Europe with the other children, and I was in South America. I wanted to have my parents to come to Argentina, and I wrote them a letter of 12 to 14 pages. My mind was good, describing the climate, the living, the conditions, the friendliness, everything. What's all about? And I said, take it from me. She says, you say yes or no? I said, no, there's the letter and do what you want. So my father didn't like it, so he came to the United States.
Now, what year was that?
My father came to the United States, I think, in 1922. And I wasn't Argentina yet. I left Argentina in 23, the end of 23. And I'm walking around here in Buenos Aires, I'm all alone, my mother's in Europe, my father is here. I say, what the heck kind of a life? I say, I loved Argentina, I enjoyed it there because I had a good job. One day I decided I'm going to go to America. I told my foreman, Domingo, I said, I'm leaving for North America. He says, you're crazy? A man in your standing? I said, maybe I am. He says, you speak a good Spanish now and everything else. You'll have to learn a different language. I said, yes, I'm going because I want to be with my family. And that was on a Tuesday. I went into the American consul, made a passport, bought a ticket on Saturday morning, I was on the boat. We came to the United States, October the 1st, 1923. And there I am.
Yeah, you came to New York.
New York, of course. I was sorry when I came to New York.
I can imagine.
When I looked at New York, I got sick. First of all, I didn't know the language. Yeah. Second time, and I didn't like the looks of the girls.
Who gave you the visa to come to
the American consul.
Just that you didn't need a person to sponsor you.
No, I was a citizen of Argentina.
No, no, I mean you didn't need a person in the United States to sponsor you?
No,
to come?
Nothing. No papers, nothing.
Amazing.
Just went in and got a visa. In fact, the consul, I was supposed to get my visa on a Thursday morning, and I didn't get it. And I came back Thursday afternoon, they still didn't call my name. So I went up to the clerk and I said to him, how come people before me got their visas, their passports, and I didn't? He says, this was at the Esto Especial, senor. So, hace para mí especial, señor. Bueno, so he went out, he got my passport, was already done. And he gave me that passport and he was waiting for that.
Uh-huh.
And I said to him, okay, señor, adios. What can he do to me? He said he wanted to get a few extra bucks. And that's it.
So what did you do when you came to New York?
When I came to New York, I rested up a week, and I got a job in a lousy grocery store, pardon my expression, $12 a week. And it was a young fella, he couldn't even afford $12, he didn't do enough business. Then I kept on working in a grocery store for a while. I worked for, would you mind shutting it off, you'll have to excuse me a minute. You got it out?
That we do.
I was working in the grocery store, one job, then another job, you know, toggling here and there, and then finally I got myself, I was working in the Bronx by a Jewish man for $15 a week, and I missed the subway 6 o'clock in the morning. I had to wait 15 minutes. For the other side, I was supposed to start at 6. They came 15 minutes late and he just paid me. So he gave me a good argument. And I took off the apron and I said, you could take your job and do whatever you feel like it. And I left and I saw I had in the paper they're looking for clerks in a chain store. I don't know, it was 3 months away. And I went up to the store, it was 149th Street and Brook Avenue. Maybe you know where it is.
In the Bronx.
And I went in there, had breakfast first, and I went into the store and the manager was there and I said, are you looking for a clerk? He says, yes, but I can't hire. I said, the big shot from the, you'll come down, the man who does the hiring. So I was waiting. In the meantime, I bought a dozen other people come down to look for the same job. So when they walked into the store and he says to him, he says, who's first? So everybody walked out, so I gave him hell by letting him walk out. I said, that's when I'm going to take this young fella. Finally, I admit, I told a couple lies that I'm very experienced. And after I started working, the manager gave me hell. He says, why did you lie? I say, you tell me what I'm doing wrong. I say, you didn't hire me, and I don't want you to fire me. I need a job. For $15, I went to $22.50. I said, tell me what you want me to do, and I'll do anything you want. And years ago, you had to sell. If a woman walked in, you got to tell her special and that, and special and that. And today, you don't have to. You take the little bell and you go. So he says, watch me what I'm going to do. And I say, okay, I'll watch you. He walks in, a young lady with a diamond in her pocket, and he was trying to sell at the store. And I'm standing in the back. That's all I made to say. I said, that's what you want me to do? I said, you didn't do so good yourself. I said, let me do the next customer. The next customer had money and a softy. Before I got through, I had a $3 sale. Oh, he said, all right. After working there for a short period of time, he recommended me as a manager. I opened up 3 stores for the same company.
Wow.
2 stores I opened. The third one I was in Beverly, 1 Rogers Avenue, and I was making $85 to $100 a week, commission. I was a tough cookie that day. And in them days was no income tax, no social security, or state, the federal, everybody, nothing. Nobody knew about it. No. So I had a good store and I was making good money there. And 4 months later, they sent down a big man from Newark, New Jersey to replace me on opening stores. And I said, called up the office, I said, if you're going to take away that store, I'm going to quit. Either you put me on a straight salary with a percentage commission, with a bonus. I say, it's no use. I work up a business, I get up to money. In the beginning, I don't make that kind of money. Till I used to get so much, $35 and 1.5% commission. When you take a new store, you don't get that kind of business,
no,
right away.
I don't.
So they changed those, listen to you, like last year's snow. After breaking that other guy in, and says, okay, we got a store for you. I said, I told you, I'm not going. And I didn't. And I went into business for myself. Mm.
The same kind of business?
I had a butter negro in New York. I opened up for beginning. In the neighborhood, I was working 4 days, so we can make $100. Covering 200 steps a day. Mm. Was no peddlers allowed in the building. I used to ring the superintendent's bell. Hello, he says, what do you want, Red? I say, you're a nice woman, I don't want anything for you. That's all I want is, I want to give you a dozen eggs. She says, what do you want to return? I say, I don't want what you think. I say, I want you to recommend me one customer on each floor. That's all I want from you. You'll get a dozen eggs every week. You walk into a building, 65 families, 100 families. He says, that's all you want? I say, I'm a farmer. I used to have printed cars from my back in New York. Come on. That's no joke.
No, I
joke.
I know it's real.
I still
got
some
an operator, that's all.
She says, okay. I say, no peddlers. I say, I'm not peddling, you're just recommending me. And I sold her out. Then I met this little girl. And we got engaged, and her brother got married in New York. And it's going to be 50 years. Next February, me and Tasham. And that's where we are.
How did you get to meet her?
I met her in New York. Her brother got married in New York. And she went to the brother's wedding. She lived in Madison.
Oh, I see.
Her parents lived in Madison. Yeah. And we got engaged in New York, and she says, come on and meet my parents. So that's where I am.
And you, how many children do you have?
Two. Son and a daughter. My son is a lawyer, my daughter is here in Madison, is with the employer in Connecticut. That's it.
So, you moved to Madison and you went into business?
Oh yes, I went into business, sure.
I got into it.
Yeah.
No enter it.
Yeah.
Just one more question. You're very involved in the synagogue, in the Chevra Kadisha. Could you just say a few things about that? About your work in the...
Well, the reason why I'm involved, because my grandfather was in the Chevra Kadisha. You know, I was asked to do it, and it's a mitzvah. I'm doing it not because it's a pleasant job.
No, it certainly is.
We get a lot of arguments sometimes for nothing. You know, you got a husband, a rabbi, you should know. You can't please everybody. Impossible.
Even if you're not a rabbi.
Even if you're not a rabbi, sure. Especially in Chevra Kadisha, we run into difficulties. We have charity cases sometimes. We charge a little fee, we don't charge much, which we have to buy the clothes and everything else, all the other trimmings, and we try to protect to keep the cemetery from goyim away and so on. Like a woman died just a month or so ago from the temple members, and I was called, and then 30 minutes later, Father called me. He says, she's not converted. Her husband is Jewish, but she's not converted. I said, forget it. I said, just put on the non-sectarian if they want to double up. There's a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
They call me anytime at night or anytime something happens. And we take all the burdens of the family. The minute they call us, I say, there's no more. They appreciate it. Some do, some don't. I'll give them the payday what we get. That's it. Sometimes we'll do some other times. We'll finish the rest. It's too much for time.
Hey, thank you very much.
Okay,
this is
a
lovely interview.
Listen, you could shut it off now.